And it feels like it's come very quickly, at least for me, because we only just started it and now we're close to ending it. And I'm not sure whether that's because the last two online retreats I did were like week-long ones, but it also, I think that's something about time goes quickly when you're kind of absorbed and engaged in an activity. You probably all had that experience when you've been meditating, that sometimes when you're meditating, it just flies by. You sit and then suddenly the bell's rung and the whole meditation's gone by without you being aware of it. Even if it's a 45 an hour long, suddenly it's the end. Usually there's times when we are quite absorbed. And then there's other times when we're quite distracted and it feels like it will never end, like the leader will never ring the bell. So retreat time's a little bit like that. It's sort of not like normal time. It's a subjective time, I think. And we are in a kind of different, well, we're in this virtual, shared virtual space, aren't we? We've created this place of practice, each of us individually in our own homes or wherever else we are, but also collectively we've created this community of practice. And yes, this is the last session. And it is different doing a retreat online and in person, I think. And I think some of that may have advantages, but one thing I would just like to encourage people is to just take a little bit of care at the end of the session, because normally you'd have a whole transition period when you're traveling back home. And here it's like you switch off your computer, you're right there, right back in your life. And it might be good to, have a little bit of care, be aware. You might need to manage a better transition. Yeah. Anyway, that's just another example of impermanence. We started the day with Padmasambhava's advice, just that opening line, first, pay urgent attention to impermanence. And in a way, the whole session that Ratnadeva led this morning, where he talked more about Padmasambhava, talked about him meditating in the cremation grounds, a lot of stuff about Darkanese. But there was very much a sense of impermanence. Yeah. So one of the things that Padmasambhava is particularly known for is transformation. He himself had many transformations, took on lots of different identities and appeared in different ways. He could transform himself, transform others. And that sort of symbolically, I think, a way of communicating that sense of how we, throughout our lifetimes, if we're practicing spiritually, we have these experiences of letting go of an old identity, growing into something new, the spiritual death, the spiritual rebirth. Yeah, that Ratnadeva was talking about earlier. And he also talked a lot about Darkanese, and we did that great Darkani ritual, the Darkani Puja. So I will be following up on some of all of those threads, but there isn't much time, so I'll just be doing it in a little way, in my own way. But there's one aspect of Padmasambhava that we haven't talked about that I always find very intriguing, so I just wanted to flag it up, even if there's not much chance to go into it more deeply, which is, well, we've talked about him being a magician, a shaman, having magical powers, these siddhis. And he's part historical. There was a figure who did bring Buddhism to Tibet that Padmasambhava and all the legends and all the stories and myths are kind of based upon. So he's part historical, part archetypal. But you can't just write him off as just sort of a figment of the mind or a manifestation of the mind. And you can't just think of him as being, just the person who existed. So one thing that I think encapsulate that is that at a certain point he called all his key disciples together and he basically warned them, because they were all based in Tibet at that point, that there would come a time when the Dharma would be facing a lot of challenges and it would fall into, the situation there would not be welcoming to Buddhists and the teachings and all that kind of stuff. And he basically gave them the task to go forth and hide teachings so that they could be rediscovered at a time when Buddhism was sort of flourishing again and people were able to make use of the teachings. And we're talking about thousands of years ago, and there's this, it comes in stories and in tales. But then we have had over the last, well, during this century and the last century, a lot of, especially like Tibetan lamas, discovering in very remote, very mysterious places, teachings, really key teachings. I find that quite mysterious, and sometimes they would say it's because of a rebirth and they knew where it was going to be. That maybe they were a reincarnation of one of those original disciples who hid the teachings. So they're called termas, these hidden teachings, and some of them are quite famous ones. But I'm not going to say more about that, but it is quite interesting that that's there. So, cremation ground. Well, that's definitely a place where it would be impossible not to pay attention or be reminded of impermanence. If you're sitting meditating in a cremation ground and there's all these bodies being burnt and all these corpses around you. So, in a way, it's quite a dramatic setting to sort of confront oneself with impermanence and also fear, I think. So very much he's someone who, he turns towards his demons, he faces his fears, creating what Ratnadeva was talking about, these intense, crucial situations for practice. And we do know that sometimes when things are challenging for us, things are painful for us, maybe we're in a time of crisis, positive things can come out of that. They can often, in a way, force us beyond our limited experience of ourselves at that particular time. And it may be painful, it may be challenging, but it may also end up having quite a lot of positive effects if we're able to make use of that. It's not to say that we want to have those experiences necessarily, but when they come, they are an opportunity for practice, they're an opportunity for change and growth and transformation, letting go of something, opening to something new. Which is why, there's this idea that even our worst enemy can be a teacher, and that everything, anything is an opportunity for practice. So, what are the things that are challenging to us? What are the things that are for us our personal cremation grounds? We were thinking a little bit about that, weren't we? I'm actually in a place where I don't actually want to think or say anything at all, rational, actually, or which is a bit difficult when you're giving a talk. But I've got kind of images and feelings and whatever, and I don't want to think, oh, this means this or this doesn't work, because sometimes when you're trying to talk about symbol and image ritual devotion, you can reduce it, you can diminish it. And also the whole thing about a symbol is it doesn't just have one meaning, it has layers and layers of meanings. Everybody would put their own meanings, their own interpretations on something, and they can all be true. It's like a poem doesn't necessarily have one meaning. A picture, people get different things out of watching a painting or listening to a piece of music. And it's the same with all these symbols. And particularly, I think, for us, when we're encountering some of the the symbols that you find in Buddhism, Mahayana, Vajrayana, they're not necessarily images, symbols that speak to us in terms of our cultural references. You know, sometimes when you immerse yourself in them, then they kind of, you create your own meaning, your own relationship to them. But I think it is also important to try and create our own equivalents. Yeah. But having said that, I've got two things I want to show you. So this here, I don't know if you can see it clearly. It's a Vajra chopper. Maybe if I put it behind a piece of paper. And Dakinis often have a Vajra chopper. and they sort of cut through the things that tie us to samsara. And they can cut through all kinds of illusions, delusions and things like that. And we were talking yesterday about Padmasambhava going into the underworld and converting demons. So there's a whole tradition with some of these, well, like Dakinis, wrathful figures who have a lot of energy. And one of the things they do is they sort of destroy the things that hold us back, you know, which may be, you know, you may have the image of a demon or something. So that picture of the Dakini this morning, you could see that she was like, she had her feet pinning down these two figures that could be demons, or as Ratnadeva was saying, representations of samsara. And we all have our personal demons, and we need to see them, we need to catch them, we need to be able to work with them. So this is where this comes in handy. You might not be able to see that very clearly, but it's a Vajra chopper. I mean, it's a Purba, which is a, it's a basically special kind of knife. It's got three sides to it, and you use it to pin down the demons. Anyway, so that may all seem a little dramatic or bloodthirsty, but sometimes I think we need something a bit energetic. So when we were talking about the Dakinis, they are so much about energy and freedom, and the energy of the mind, the energy of, in a way, a personification of free flowing energy, uninhibited, unrestrained, and able to then be directed towards our spiritual practice on growth or whatever it is that we're trying to do. So traditionally, actually, enlightenment is sometimes described as having three aspects. Sometimes people focus on two, which is compassion and kindness and love. So compassion and wisdom, the two wings of the bird, two sides that are both the same, just seen from a different perspective. But it's also seen as having three elements. And that's quite interesting that the third one, which is energy, is often not given as much attention. But it is also seen that enlightenment experience is made up of energy, wisdom, and compassion. And quite often our energy is blocked. And that's why these kinds of practices, doing rituals, meditating, even doing body work, can really help free that energy. And it's quite interesting that in the Tantra, there's a different version of the five precepts, which is all about energy. So, you know, when we make a commitment to following the spiritual path and the things that we're trying to work with, the things we're trying not to do, you know, the traditional things are like, we're trying not to harm, we're trying to cultivate kindness, we're trying to be kind and generous and not take the not given, we're trying to be honest, not to say things that aren't true. We're trying to be mindful, not cloud our minds or get intoxicated with things that get in the way of us being mindful. And also sexual, we're trying to be ethical sexually, yeah? So they're all quite standard things that we're trying to abstain from doing and things that we're trying to cultivate in a more positive way. But in the Tantra, you get a version of the precepts which is all about energy and how we use energy. So the first one is that we try not to obstruct the energy of another person. That's quite something, isn't it? Just thinking about the times we may do that and also the times when other people do that to us. And that's another version of the not harming and the one of being kind, being loving towards others. So it's interesting that it's about freeing that energy, and not obstructing energy, allowing that energy to manifest in the way it wants to be directed in the way it needs to be, without getting in the way. There's the second one is about not draining the energy of others and giving freely of our own energy. And I guess we've all probably also had that experience of being with people that completely drain our energy. And maybe there've been times when we've done that to others as well. I know I have. Can be almost like a psychic or emotional vampire at times. You just need, and may take other people's energy. So that's seen as something we're trying to work with on an ethical level, which is interesting, isn't it? And the generosity, the giving, is giving of your energy. And energy can be outward and very energetic, but it can also be kind of calm, can't it? It can be quite inward, it can be quite receptive. So it's quite interesting looking at how free we are with our energy. Do we give it? Where do we give it? How do we give it? In what ways? And do we at times drain other people's energy? And we've also got trying not to misuse energy. So what might that be, misusing energy? I guess for everybody it would be different, but I think the thing is that all our actions, everything we do or don't do, whether it's in our minds, in our speech, in our actions in the world, where we physically use our body, all require energy, all use energy. And we can put that to good use or to bad use. And we can put that to destructive use or constructive use. And we often have a choice. And sometimes we're not conscious of the choices we make, but sometimes we are, and we just decide to do what we want to do, knowing that actually that energy could be used in more helpful, more constructive ways. The fourth precept is about actually using appropriate energy and using the energy that's needed for whatever the purpose is, whatever the task is, appropriately. And the final one is about not just allowing that energy to become stuck and turgid and not get used, but to keep it bright, clear, in a sort of good state that can be used. And I think some of that is about like purifying the energy in a way, if you want to use that kind of language and imagery. So anyway, I just went down a little bit of a rabbit hole around the tantric precepts, because I do think it does link in with the stuff with the Darkanese. And Darkanese are passionate, they're full of energy. They're quite, I've always found them quite scary, actually. I find them totally fascinating and I'm drawn to them, and I'm also like, oh, they're a bit too scary for me, a bit too challenging for me. I mean, they can be passionate, they can be wrathful, they can be all kinds of things. They can take on any kinds of forms as well. But one thing, I noticed Vasantra says that Darkanese always spell death for the ego. So they always challenge your egos, and I think that's probably one reason I find them a little bit scary and sometimes want to keep my distance. Because we don't really want, you know, there's the whole death and rebirth, but our egos like to cling on, don't they? They want to be how they were, defend ourselves from that change, even though we know that change is inevitable and just part of everything. So what I would like to do actually at this point is read Padmasambhava's advice to the three fortunate women that I was quoting from in the early morning meditations the last couple of days. So when we get to them, there are a couple of lines that will seem very familiar. And actually, what I want to do is read it where you're just listening to it and thinking about it in a more rational mind. And then a bit later, we'll do a little bit of sitting. And it'll be a bit more like a reflection where I'll kind of drop in lines from that. Not necessarily the whole reading, but lines from that when we're a little bit more meditative space and just seeing what effect it has. Because when our mind's in a different mode, sometimes we understand it, process things. Have insights in a different kind of a way. So this is the advice given by Padmasambhava to the three fortunate women. Then Nanchung, the glorious noble queen, invited the Guru, that second Buddha, into the temple of turquoise dedicated to her tutelary deities. Piling up on precious throne, fine silks and tables of divination, and regaling him with many pleasing things, she greeted him respectfully and made this request. Give me a few words of great import, an effective verse which I can memorize. Though I have not renounced the world, I would like to cherish within me a doctrine which at a later time would lead me to Buddhahood. To this the Guru replied, listen, Queen Nanchung. To begin with, pay urgent attention to impermanence. Then strongly turn your mind towards taking refuge and direct your prayers to the lamas. These are the preliminaries without which no means exist. After that, disposing yourself physically to be calm, as in an empty house the raindrops slowly gather, relax. Do not force your mind or body. Since the tranquility of shunyata is the foundation, by forcefully turning your mind to emptiness, you chase misconceptions. In the thoughts which arise, understanding will come without doing anything. Again and yet again, work on whatever estranges you from meditation. Lay bare whatsoever arises, good and bad thoughts alike. The child who knows his way carries along the path every harmless thing he happens upon and nothing that harms him. During the time of insight, which is surrounded by a calm and gentle aura, openness and appearance are inseparable. The six senses come forth, though appearance and voidness are inseparable. This is the real foundation, without which no means exists. During the period of meditation, there is not anything. It is simply open. But whenever you waver towards appearances, delusions will arise. After careful examination, understand not to discriminate, to neither accept nor reject. as anything can happen, peace will arise from within. Even when you do not meditate, for personal growth you need to exercise effort. If you do so without accomplishing anything thereby, know that at all times realization is your own nature, and from within act for the benefit of all beings. Unceasingly do Dharma actions. When you purify yourself or your faults, realization will naturally come from within. Seal your virtuous action with prayers and a dedication for the purpose of all beings. Without such prayers and dedication, no means exists. Not falling into the errors of excitement or passivity, be filled with confidence. Here, in a few words of great import, lie preparation, enactment, and fulfillment. The doctrine's deepest reaches of this life as of the life to come. Thus did he speak, and Queen Nanchung was led to salvation. There's a lot in that reading. And again, it's one of those things that for different people, different things might stand out, different things might resonate, have meaning. Or the same thing might have different meanings for other people. And actually, any time that I read that or hear that, maybe different things resonate for me. So I've been very much into the relax, do not force your mind or body. During the meditation, there's not anything, it's simply open, so that receptivity. But also what's interesting is that he's also saying we need energy, we need action, we need to make an effort, even though we're not trying to force anything. And that peace will arise from within. Realization will arise from within. So that intrinsic Buddha nature, the insight, the qualities that we have, original purity in a way, we can uncover through our practice, through creating the right conditions, for that peace to arise, for that realization to come from within. And I think with the Vajras, Choppers, with the Purbas, with the converting the demons, with the sky dancers of the Darkanese, a lot of that is about how we free ourselves, how we liberate ourselves from the things that hold us back, from the things that stop us realizing that that Buddha nature, that realization. That things that get in the way of us being the best we can be, or just being who we can be, who we're meant to be, by realizing the potential we have. Each of us individual, each of us different, but we each have something there to be realized. And we each probably have had all kinds of conditioning and all kinds of things that get in the way. Which we've internalized in all kinds of ways, that we ourselves block our energy, we ourselves cage ourselves, don't let ourselves be free. Which is a challenge, isn't it? To allow ourselves to go beyond that. And that's why quite often we can't do the work, or we don't allow ourselves to do the work. And then what happens is there's a crisis, there's a crucial situation where we have to do the work in order to get through it, in order to rise above it. But there's this idea that if we can just access it, There's this openness. We can go beyond all these dualities, all these limited ways of thinking. Our minds, our hearts can be limitless. The energy of the enlightened mind that the Darkonese personify, that can move in any direction, free, flowing, spontaneous, creative. That's all within us and without us. You know, it's going beyond our very ego-based, small mind, small awareness or view of the world, view of ourselves. Without a center, without an edge, the luminous expanse of awareness that encompasses all, this vivid, bright vastness, natural, primordial presence. Without an inside, without an outside, awareness arisen of itself, as wide as the sky, beyond size, beyond direction, beyond limits. This utter, complete openness, space inseparable from awareness. Within that birthless, wide open expanse of space, phenomena appear like rainbows, wholly transparent. Pure and impure realms, Buddhas and sentient beings are seen, brilliant and distinct. As far as the sky pervades, so does awareness. As far as awareness extends, so does absolute space. Sky, awareness, absolute space, indistinguishable, intermixed, immense, infinitely vast, the ground of samsara, the ground of nirvana. To remain day and night in this state, to enter this state easily, this is joy. Emma Ho. So that's a poem that comes from Journey to Enlightenment about the life and world of Khyentsey Rinpoche, which again to me encapsulates something of this whole territory. Anyway, let's do some meditation now. And it won't be like a formal meditation. It will be very much, part meditation, part reflection in a way. But just sitting, relaxing the body, relaxing the mind, just being open, and just when I drop in a phrase or a sentence, just allow it to ripple out in your psyche. Don't have to understand it. Just allow the words to be there. Open and receptive to whatever emerges. To begin with, pay urgent attention to impermanence. and strongly turn your mind towards taking refuge. And direct your prayers to the lamas. After that, disposing yourself physically to be calm. As in an empty house, the raindrops slowly gather. Relax. Do not force your body or your mind. Since the tranquility of emptiness is the foundation, by forcefully turning your mind to emptiness, you chase misconceptions. And the thoughts which arise, understanding will come without doing anything. Again and yet again, work on whatever estranges you from meditation. Lay bare whatever arises. In a time of insight, openness and appearance are inseparable. During the period of meditation, there is not anything. It is simply open. Whenever you waver towards appearances, delusions will arise. understand, to not to discriminate. Understand not to discriminate, to neither accept nor reject. Anything can happen. Peace will arise from within. Know that at all times, realization is your own nature, and from within, act for the benefit of all beings. Realization will naturally come from within. And always pay urgent attention to impermanence. If you just stay there for a moment, Patnadeva is going to chant the slow Padmasambhava mantra.
Om Aum Atra Guru Padma Sri Hong 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 Om Aum Vajra Guru Atma Sri Om. Om Vajra Guru Atma Sri Om. Om Aha 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 Om Vajra Guru Atma Sri Om.
So in a way, we've just had a brief encounter with Padmasambhava. Maybe something of this weekend has touched you, opened something. Maybe it feels all very strange or weird. Maybe it's intriguing, maybe exciting, maybe it's something you're not at all interested in, but you've had a encounter and experience. And we've been trying to make this a retreat where it is much more experiential. It's not just about knowledge and understanding and teachings, which is why we've been doing a lot of meditation and ritual. And if you remember that quote from Sangharakshita about the effort we put into our spiritual development needs to be directed towards the growth of the whole psyche, not just a part of it. We need to unify our energies, and that means enlisting the cooperation of our unconscious energies by means of myth and symbol, by the exercise of emotion, imagination, devotion. The rational approach will not do it on its own. So we haven't just been doing a rational approach, but for some people that might be very annoying. And for some people, the stuff may not have had any effect, that's fine. But anyway, at least you might have a little bit of a sense of who Padmasambhava is and some of the symbolism associated with him, including that of the Dakinis. He's very closely connected with Dakinis and also with female feminine energy. You know, a lot of his key disciples were women, and also he had teachers who were women, Dakinis taught him as well. And you've seen maybe in images and in statues, sometimes he has a staff, that Katvanga that Ratnadeva mentioned, and I always find it quite intriguing that apparently there's one time when he wanted to go somewhere and bring his top female disciple with him, and he knew that she wouldn't be welcome, so he transformed her into the staff and brought her along in that way. Anyway, just one of those sort of numerous magical transformations associated with Padmasambhava. But I think there's something very much about sort of unifying and utilizing all kinds of energy, but including that feminine energy or archetype. And that can be very wild, like the Dakini, very powerful. And it can be calm and relaxed. Anyway, we're going to go into groups in a moment, which will be kind of like reporting out groups, because as we're getting towards the end of the retreat, it can be nice just to sort of connect up with some of the people from the retreat and also to sort of share some of your experiences, what it's been like for you. You know, things you found challenging, things you found helpful or inspiring, whatever, doesn't matter, just what your experience is. But it may be helpful to just think about if there's anything that you'll be taking away from the retreat that feels sort of positive or helpful. And in a way, part of that transition, just sort of like acknowledging with a few other people that, you know, this has been quite an intense couple of days, and it's going to come to an end soon, and that being part of that transition process. We're also, after that, we'll come back to the big group for a little bit, and we will do kind of, well, not a ritual, well, very short ritual ending acknowledgement, and bit about what next and various other things. But before we do that, I just wanted to say a very big thank you to all of you for coming and practicing and engaging with the material so much. It's really made it a very fulfilling and exciting place to be, actually. I've really enjoyed it, engaging with you all, practicing with you all. Anyway, so Ratnadeva, do you want to put us in groups. And actually, what you could do, he'll put you in groups, but maybe go off and get a cup of tea and then come back to your groups with a cup of tea or whatever you want to be drinking.
Dave, how much time do we have in groups?
Oh yeah, how long?
I think we probably have about 20 to 25 minutes. Say 25, including getting a cup of tea. Sorry, I lost my bit of paper that had all the timings on it.
So I'm broadcasting a message to say that groups will finish at 17:25.
Okay.
25 minutes time.
Right. Can you end the recording?